page 44?
Yeah.
Page 44.
Okay. Chilly day, but a beautiful day. Glad to be here. The title of this message is A Man Convinced Against His Will Is of the Same Mind Still. One of the famous quotes often used by Dale Carnegie. All of us know it's true that a man convinced against his will is of the same mind still. Actually, it's worse than that. And we're going to look at that a little bit. It's actually even worse than that. They did some empirical research, Brandon Nyhan and others, 2010. But there have been other studies least I've heard about, they had similar results. University of Michigan, where on various issues, they polled people and got a position, and they stated what their position was. Then they exposed them to strong facts that contradicted their position, or facts on the opposite side. So if people are logical, you'd expect it to move them a little more on the poll the other way. But you guessed it. It was the exact opposite. The opposite effect. They moved further away from those facts they were given. Further to the position that they originally held. In other words, a man convinced against his will is even more in support of it, even if he is exposed to facts to the contrary. And people, you know, they say logic, I mean, emotions trump logic. You know, if you're dealing with public opinion and large groups of people, it's true. If you can get them emotionally supporting whatever the position is, logic will have little or no effect on it. It might even drive them further in the direction they want to go or they're in. So you can't convince people in spite of even correct facts. And people seek out, as the University of Michigan study mentioned, sources of information that agree with what they already think. That, of course, is not so surprising. And hard facts dissuade people. It drives them the other way. It's kind of, people believe that what they're doing, or what they believe, or what they think is right, no matter what. And this is quoted in Dale Carnegie's book. He lists a whole bunch of gangsters, including Al Capone. Do you know that Al Capone saw himself as a humanitarian? Now, there were times when he did operate a soup kitchen in Chicago. But you're going to say, but what about the beer wars where they killed a bunch of people and beat up a whole bunch of other people and gang fighting? Probably if Al Capone could be brought back to the grave, he'd probably say, well, that was a necessary evil of the empire that I was building. You could say, well, what about some of the other things like prostitution rings he ran? I'm sure he'd have some excuse. Al Capone thought of himself not as a thug and a gangster or criminal, but as a humanitarian. Yeah, and he goes through the book a list of other gangsters who didn't see themselves accurately. For instance, if you talk to an atheist, and I have an article there. Remember I mentioned to you all about this book that came out, Privileged Planet, where this astronomer who was well thought of, so he wrote this book and then he lost tenure. He showed how the planet Earth is special, like, I believe, like 125 ways, which I can't remember them because it's scientific, but we have to have a perfect orbit around the sun and not be exposed to radiation, non-radiation. In other words, all the other planets they can find in the vast universe have got all kinds of things why life couldn't exist on those planets. And you'd have to read the book. But now they've actually done more research, and they found even more factors why Earth and life on Earth is special. I think it's over 200. And it supports what's called intelligent design. In other words, if I came to you and I showed you this well-run machine that was perfectly timed and everything, and you said, oh, well, billions of years of sand and sawdust and metal chips made this machine, you'd laugh me out of the room, right? It has to be designed. Well, apparently this robust planet Earth is a lot more well-designed than we ever thought. And, it, you know, and by the way, the most radical leftist department on almost every college campus that I'm aware of is the biology department. You're going to say, why the biology department? Because their stated position is evolution, and they don't believe in anything outside of what they call natural science. They don't want to hear anything about designers, creators, theology. They're totally against all that. But the more they learn about biology, which includes plants and animals, the more design keeps slapping them in the face. Design, design. You know, DNA, RNA, you know, all that stuff There's no such thing as a simple cell. So what do? They become more radicalized. Even students who are conservatives complain to me, boy, these biology professors, they're the most... And they go into other subjects like global warming and how conservatives are evil. I mean, they're just radical. It's because they're running from an obvious truth. And every study they do, what do they find inside the cells of animals? Design, design, and more design. Anyway, I have that article for you all to look at. And as I say, now they've expanded what that guy did in the book. They found out a lot more things that just apparently it's astronomical to think it happened by accident. As I say, they've been searching, I believe, billions of planets or whatever it is exactly with all these telescopes in space. They can't find a planet anywhere close to Earth. Earth is so special, it's like, you know, it's the opposite. You know, in the Star Trek movies, it's always, well, this planet's just a little different, this is a little different. And they all these lives are like ours, just a little different. Either it's well-designed like Earth, or it's all that other disastrous stuff. By the way, did you know that our solar system is built to protect Earth? We have two major big planets with big orbits, magnetic orbits, that are outer, so all the major junk from outer space gets sucked up by Saturn. In other words, like Earth has two big shields around it. The moon helps too, but I'm just saying, and I learned that about 10 years ago, but you never think of that. Well, that's just pure luck, right? Sure. And all those other factors, which I'm not smart enough to remember, but read the book. It's not luck. The point I'm getting at is atheists get more and more bullheaded the more the facts slap them upside the head that no, life is well designed. You take any animal, you take even a normal animal like a dog. Do you realize that dogs are well designed? And take a wolf pack up in Alaska. You know, they're really well designed for what they do. That's one of the most powerful things in the wild is a wolf pack. They're fast. Dogs are very athletic. They got great hearing, great smelling. That's why they can use, like, cadaver dogs. Those dogs can smell things that, I don't know, all I'm saying is, and dogs are smart. I mean, as a predator, they're smart. They work together. I mean, you tell me dogs aren't well designed. But you could say that about raccoons and, you know, any butterflies, anything you think of, what God built them for. And even if you get in an argument with someone and they concede a point, usually by the next day or two, they've forgotten that and they've hardened their position. That's what we find in human nature. They're more convinced ever. This is a true story. A man had a nice aunt, but she's pro-abortion because she thinks that's what she should be, you know, women's right to abort their baby. He's anti-abortion. So he quoted her some statements from, I believe, two progressive congresspersons from California who wanted to pass a bill, but it hasn't passed yet, where if a mother wanted to get rid of her baby, she had up to 2 weeks after the baby is born to kill it. And he says, boy, that is shocking. Wait till I tell my aunt that. He told his aunt that, and he was shocked that she didn't disagree with that. She was so much into abortion that, and that's murder. I mean, that's more blatant murder. Cute little baby. Oh, but the mother decides she doesn't want it. She should have a right to get rid of it. By the way, and some abortions are botched. The baby is born alive. I mean, you know, I think technically they got to put scissors in the back of their head before it comes out of the birth canal or something like that or various other things, not to shock you all. But sometimes they miss or something goes wrong. The baby just drops out, starts breathing. It's alive. Well, I'm just telling you something. Well, if that's her desire, she'd be able to kill it. And you're shocked when you hear that. And this is not an evil woman. This is not like an evil woman. This is just a normal woman. But she feels she has to support abortion, even to the extreme. When someone tells you what late-term abortion can actually, how far they want to take it. She was that much, and he was shocked, in support of it. Well, what does all this mean for Christians? Let's look at Jeremiah 17:9. I wasn't going to read the scripture, but I thought, well, I know we all know it, but maybe we ought to read it anyway. Jeremiah 17:9. It's often quoted because, well, it's just the kind of scripture that as we think about our human nature and the human nature of other people, it's just good to remember what God says. Jeremiah 17:9 says, the heart, or we could say the mind or the heart is deceitful. In other words, it's not honest, it's not logical, it's deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? You know, at some point you think, well, people are smart and very capable of logic, but that doesn't mean they're always logical and act smartly. People, well, this human behavior is just an absolute mess, as all of us know. Let's go to the book of Proverbs and look at some of the things that God says about human behavior, and see how we Christians can benefit from knowing these things. Proverbs 14:12. There's a way which seems right unto a man, but the end or the results are death. Let me just take an obvious example. Take the French Revolution. When you read about it, you know, all these people wanted to get rid of the king, and they wanted to create, I guess if we were probably talking to some of the people involved, they wanted to create the socialist paradise. I mean, that's probably how they would have worded it, socialist paradise. But you realize that over 30,000 people were butchered in internal fighting. I mean, it really got dangerous. At one point, they killed 300 babies in a field publicly to frighten their opposition, how brutal they would be. And there are gruesome examples. They put people on barges and sunk it in the middle of the river so people could see what they did to the opposition. And the guillotine was working. Boom, boom, chopping off necks. Well, it's a great story to read because one side would be up, you know, and they'd call each other citizen, and then they'd lose power, and then they're running for their lives, and it was like chaos. And, of course, Napoleon said the only way to take care of this chaos is a military dictatorship. And that's what they ended up with, which was bad for France in other ways. Well, I think there are a lot of ideas that people have, like socialist paradise, communist paradise. And if you read Engels and Marx, you know, that's the original book on communism, the Communist Manifesto, it sounds like everybody will share equally and the government will see to it that everything is fair. And when you read it, it sounds like, wow, this would be a socialist paradise. It just doesn't work. What could I say? And people have all kinds of ideas. And then when the unintended consequences come in, those God's ways are best. Now, a lot of human ideas, they sound good on paper. And people think, it's right, it's wonderful. But the unintended consequences are a disaster. And the human ego is a problem. Because once the ego gets involved, no matter how bad it is, they can't admit they were wrong and change course. they got to protect. Let me give you one example. A reporter walked up to Jane Fonda, it was a few years ago, and said, you know, you helped the communists win in Indochina, Vietnam, you know, Vietnam, Cambodia, etc. You helped the communists win. And after, you know, they won and the West left and the communists had total control, over 4 million people were butchered by the communists. Pol Pot did most of it, but some of the other dictators threw in there hundreds of thousands as well. You think Jane Fonda said, oh, you know, maybe I was wrong. Maybe the communists didn't create this socialist paradise. And I maybe had to rethink it or something went wrong. Guess who she blamed? America. Now, America was kicked out and all the other Western powers. And there were no, I'm not making this up, because you're thinking, no, we weren't involved. We were kicked out. We had no influence like, you know, we would have had over the South Vietnamese government like we had with South Korea. She blamed America. Well, if we hadn't bothered them, then maybe they wouldn't have gotten so mean and crazy. I mean, it's like, are you kidding me? By the way, the Western media, because I was involved being a Vietnam vet, I know this from experience when the Tet Offensive we won, but our media portrayed as a communist victory, and they helped them all they could. Well, when things went wrong in Cambodia, I mean, in Vietnam, after we left, what do you think the American media did with that story? They spiked it. They hid the story. You had to read certain books, investigate. We hear no evil. We see no evil. We know no evil. I'm not making this up. If you looked at the American media, you would think, well, they just kind of disappeared into the darkness. Nobody knows what's going on over there. Sure, there's plenty of evidence as people escaped. Most of them escaped on wooden boats to Hong Kong. You can read about the story. And as a matter of fact, a student just in my class last year, she's an older person now, but she escaped as a young woman, and she tells an unbelievable tale of pirates attacking their wooden boat before they got to Hong Kong. She thought she would be raped because she was only about 17. And it's a hair-raising story, but eventually, after bad things happened, they, in Malaysia, they finally did get to Hong Kong and then America. But she, of course, is against communism, and her dad spent 5 years in a re-education camp. It's really a gulag, a prison. But it gives you some idea. But the West, no, we didn't do anything wrong. We supported that evil. They know nothing about it. You never hear any analysis of where did things go wrong in the communist empire. You're not going to hear that in NBC. If you do hear it, I'm going to be shocked and surprised, even though they help the bad guys win. Proverbs 16:18. And by the way, there's a book called A Little Black Book of Communism, and it tells about 100 million people, 100 million that the communist empire has killed. You know, Castro killed maybe smaller numbers. Stalin and Mao killed larger numbers. But if you add them all up, in most people, the 20th century, most Western historians, they never teach that because it doesn't fit their position. And I guarantee you, most people can go through high school and college and not even be aware of that. Stalin killed 3 or 4 times more than Hitler, and Mao probably 5 times more. And the North Koreans, they did a lot too. I think he's the only one of the original bad communist leaders who are still around, the North Koreans and Castro. Proverbs 16:18, or Castro's brother, pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. A lot of times people make terrible mistakes because they're proud, they support whatever their ego supports, they do not want to admit they might be making a mistake. And that can get you in big trouble. Better, verse 19, to be of a humble spirit, lowly, than to divide the spoil with the proud. So God says it's better to be humble. So that's what we Christians should be, humble and able to admit when we're wrong, or we need to improve, we can do better. That's the best thing. Proverbs 16:25. You notice God says this more than once. It must mean something. There's a way that seems right unto a man, but the ends thereof, or the results, are the way of death. Interesting. You know, that's there. We should be willing to repent and say we're wrong. And our world and our society has a lot of problems. People should admit it. So when we approach people, knowing how big the human ego is, and if you offend the ego, you have no idea. Let's see what Paul says, because Paul was very successful in converting a lot of people. As it says in the book of Acts chapter 16, he turned the world upside down. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 9, and we're going to see Paul's advice on dealing with the tricky human ego. Here's Paul's advice on approaching people. And I think it would help us Christians too. 1 Corinthians 9, verse 20. 9:20. Well, I'll start in verse 19. For though I be free from all men, in other words, Paul didn't work for anybody. He got to make his own decisions. Yet have I made myself servant unto all. Isn't that a great attitude? And I think that's what God wants us to have. We're here to serve freely as much as we can, that I might gain the more, I mean more converts to Christianity. Unto the Jew I became as a Jew, that I might gain the Jews. Them that are under the law, as the law, that I might gain them that are under the law. You know, there's people who think they, their only way to be saved is keeping the law perfectly. To them that are without the law, as without the law, being not without the law to God, but under the law to Christ, that I might gain them that are without the law. To the weak became I as weak. So if somebody is very weak, Paul would emphasize that he has his weaknesses too. I made all things to all men that I might by all means save some. Now, think about that. Paul would adjust his approach to people to find points of agreement. So if we want to approach people, don't argue with them. Find points of agreement and start there. Find points of agreement and start there. And I've made that mistake so many times. I was talking to somebody recently, and I was starting to learn. He said things that I would have jumped all over a few months ago, but I'm sad. I didn't argue. I just kind of adjusted the subject and talked with him, got my own ideas in there, but didn't argue. So that's probably the best you can do. When you argue with people, it just drives them the opposite direction you want them to go. And we have to be humble enough to follow the Bible, even if it's something that we don't want to do. And know that others have to be approached carefully. Now, I want to tell you this corny joke. It's called, the joke is about Morris the Miser. So Morris the Miser needs to get a hearing aid. So he goes to a store, and his wife says, look, you're always being a miser and picking the cheapest thing. You should go for quality this time. Well, Morris the Miser, yeah, that just drives him the other way. He talks to salesman and says, well, give me the price range on hearing aids. He says, well, we have $2,000 hearing aids, $2,000 hearing aids, and $2 hearing aids. Well, any reasonable person would, you know, pick something in the middle. But Morris the Miser says, tell me about the $2, the cheapest thing you've got. So the salesman says, well, it's got a little cheap earplug and a little cord that, you know, goes, and a little cord goes in your pocket. Well, Morris the Miser says, well, how does it work if that's all there is to it? He says, well, it doesn't work, except people, when they see the cord and then you have a hearing aid, they speak louder. So, anyway, you can't get Morris the Miser telling you he goes the opposite direction. But we live in a world full of lies, half-truths, and deceptions. Let's go to Isaiah 59. And this is a scripture that talks about lies almost forming like spider webs. They're so complicated and they just create all kinds of problems for the liars as they have to cover one lie with another. And then in Isaiah 59:4, Isaiah is inspired to write. This is about, of course, Israel and Judah and their decline. None calls for justice, nor any pleads for truth. In other words, nobody is saying we need to give the pure truth to the public. We stand for truth. No, and much of what I see in education, media, law, Hollywood is not objective truth. It is, I guess they call it progressive bias. That's probably what they would call it. But definitely not standing for truth. None calls for truth. They trust in vanity. They speak lies. They speak lies. They conceive mischief and bring forth iniquity. Verse 14, Isaiah 59, verse 14. Judgment is turned away backward. In other words, a lot of weird things are decided. Things that aren't just, aren't good, and are not right. Justice stands afar off. Truth is falling in the streets. If you watch much of the media today, you'd have to say, at least on some issues, truth is falling in the streets. You know, you may get half the truth, maybe. You still not get the full story. Truth has fallen in the streets. Equity or fairness cannot enter. Yea, truth faileth, and he that departs from evil makes himself a prey. In other words, if you speak too much truth, they attack you. The opposite of what you think. In other words, if you're saying all the, I guess you might call it the PC line, whether it's true or not, oh, that's wonderful. But if you speak too much truth, you become a target. And they attack you. I heard this yesterday. A politician was told by some pundits, you cannot successfully run for president. And why? Because you're an elder in your Baptist church and your strong Christian values and beliefs. The media will not tolerate a person for president with that kind of background. They will tear you apart. Not that he's done a lot of evil stuff, because he's too much of a Christian. He's not supporting the stuff they once supported. And I don't think they were mean when they said it. They really believe that this guy cannot get fair treatment in the media because he's a Bible believer. There's a shock for you. And in Romans 3:8, Paul complains that people were lying about him. He was saying things that were true, and they were lying about him. I want to just read it real briefly. We're not going to have a big discussion of it, but Paul, of course, was doing what God wanted him to do, but they were lying about him. They attacked him for the truth. Romans 3, verse 8. And not rather, as we are slanderously reported. In other words, they were slanderously slandering Paul's reputation. See, Paul preached grace. Not that grace means the law is done away, as we already talked about. Or not that grace means you should be evil and law-breaking and steal and rob and lie and cheat and have idols. We all know that. But somehow, his enemies were slanderously saying he did. Notice what it says. And not rather, as we be slanderously reported, and some affirm that we say, let us do evil, that good may come, whose damnation is just. Those, they took Paul out of context and attacked his position. It's like they attack people that are trying to do the good thing. And you'll see that. I remember this one congressman from Minnesota. It seemed like they went after her and her husband, to me, because she stood for too much truth. At least that's how it seemed to me. remember, you never win an argument. So I want to just cover a few things that Dale Carnegie says in his books about how to approach people. One is you should try to avoid arguing with them if you can. He also says, show some respect to the other person's opinion and never say to them, you're wrong, turkey, even when they are wrong. It's better, I call it indirect denial, where you don't say it, but maybe after a little bit of talk, you indirectly and gradually, like turning a big ship around, you start to slowly show them what's true. But you got to do it gently and gradually so you don't upset their ego. Because if you say you are wrong, you've lost. I mean, no matter what happens, you've lost. begin in a friendly way. I think that's what Paul was saying in Corinthians. Begin in a friendly way. Let them know that you're their friend, you like them, and keep it on a friendly level. And if you can get the person to say yes right away, something they can agree with. Well, we both agree that we want better families in America. Oh, yes. You get them started, and you get some yes, yes, yeses going. You get things off in a positive direction. And let them do a great deal of the talking. And I know listening is hard for some of us, but we've got to learn to become better listeners. Be sympathetic with the other person's ideas. Just realize they are probably miseducated. I mean, really, a lot of the people in key places, they've been miseducated by all this wrong ideas that have taken over education, higher education, the media, for decades now. They don't know any better. They don't understand the Bible, and they've been watching Hollywood movies, and, you know, that's their definition of right and wrong, or talk shows like The View or whatever. There are a bunch of others. I don't really watch them, but I know that they influence a lot of people's perspective on what's right and what's wrong, and those shows are miseducating the public. So appeal to their nobler motives. Dale Carnegie wrote here that, say if you're a landlord and your renter is several months behind in his rent, he says you can send them a scathing letter denouncing them, but it probably won't do you any good. He says better to send them a letter saying you know that they are honest and they're good people and they wish to do the right thing and they want to get their rent, get it, you know, on schedule. Give them a nobler, positive motive to do the right thing, and you have a better chance that they will do a good thing. And I think Dale Carnegie's right. And ask God to help open their minds and keep our minds open, because we have to be honest with ourselves. You know, one of the hardest things to do is to be objective about yourself. It's easy to look at somebody else's problem. Usually it's easier. And be objective about them. You're a shopaholic and you got this problem and that problem. But it's harder to be objective about yourself. So ask God to help all of us to be more objective about ourselves. Matthew 13. I want to make a point here that someone likened it, if you see the truth, because God like reached in the back of your brain and flip the switch to open your eyes, open your mind, that you could see it clearly. And Matthew 13, verse 15, 16. Now, there's more to the story. He's quoting Isaiah, but I want to just look at this part of it. Matthew 13, 15, and 16. And this is quoting Isaiah. But he's talking about the Israelites, and, of course, Christ is talking to the Jewish Israelites. For this people's heart is waxed. Or it could be dull of hearing, another way of saying it. This people's heart is waxed gross. Their ears are dull of hearing. Their eyes have they closed, lest at any time they should see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and should be converted, and I should heal them. In other words, they've got some kind of guard, I'm going to call that, a gate on their mind that they won't hear clearly and they won't see clearly because they don't want to follow the truth. You know, when you look at the Israelites and one from one perspective, they saw unbelievable miracles. The Red Sea, like two walls of water or something like that. And they saw all those miracles and manna from heaven and just the way it was done. And yet, at some basic level, they didn't want God's way and they didn't want to follow God or Moses, and they, at least their older generation. And they kept rebelling. They didn't want to see it. And I guess in some ways they didn't see it, in spite of the evidence smacking them upside the head of all those miracles. And then it says in verse 16, but blessed are your eyes, for they see. We should thank God that we do see the truth and we can see the world a little more objectively than a lot of people can. It's like one congresswoman was asked about the riots, and I couldn't believe it. It's on television. And the reporter said, well, would you like to hear the facts of the case? The congresswoman said, no, I don't want to hear any facts I know what I want to believe. And I was shocked. I mean, I knew she felt that way, but I thought she'd make some kind of excuse. You know how you can, how good politicians can tightrope a fence and double talk her way out of it. But she was just blunt. No, I don't want the facts. And the reporter didn't give them to her. She didn't want it. We see the truth. We're called to be part of that first cadre that will help the world. We just have to hang with it, though it's not popular. In Matthew 7, people tend to go what they call the bandwagon effect. We're going to go Matthew 7, 13. The bandwagon effect is people go where they've actually done experiments. We saw one in a program called The Mind Game. They put up a line in front of a Vegas hotel. There was nothing to it. But people say if there's a line, a bunch of people in line, the bigger the line got, the more people wanted to join it. And it was a cute little story. But people go where the numbers are, which is understandable. And so Matthew 7:13 says to us, enter in at the straight gate, for wide is the gate and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many that go in thereat. Because straight or narrow is the way that leads to life, and few find it. In other words, in this age, the vast majority are going the worldly way, and it's hard to resist that. Only a few are going the true way. And so it takes God's power to help us see it and do it and want it. Then he says, verse 15, beware of false prophets. Because there are teachers who will give you some little clever song and dance to get you to follow the wrong way. And it's natural to follow the herd, sort of like lemmings, you know, going off the cliff. It's easy to do that. It is easy to do it. So I think we should thank God that we can see the truth. We should realize that it will be to our advantage. We may get to be in a place of safety during the Great Tribulation when the rest of the world is going to suffer, hopefully. Or if we pass away before then, when we're resurrected, it would be just like that, the day we close our eyes on a deathbed, we'll wake up and we'll be in God's family. Think about it. You'll be in God's family. I mean, that is so wonderful. It's kind of amazing. Let's go to Romans 8 as we close this message. Just want to make a general statement because Romans 8 is such a great chapter of the Bible. I just want to make a general statement in Romans 8. And it says in verse 18, for I reckon the sufferings of this present time, you know, not being popular, are not worthy to be compared with the glory that we're going to see. In verse 21, because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of the corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. And the whole creation groans and waits for the sons of God. It's like the planet Earth is groaning for our birth into God's family, and God's blessings will be poured to Earth. If you think Earth is a privileged planet now, which it is, it's going to be fabulous when we take the soil and make it beautiful all over the world, and whatever terraforming God's going to do with mountains and deserts and all the things that we've talked about before, it's going to be fabulous. Fabulous. So think of that when you have to go against the foe.